Today's program is brought to you by Byright, a family-owned and San Francisco-grown market that's passionate about creating community through food. For more information, visit ByrightMarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Meant to Be Eaten. I'm your host, Andrea Ween, and joining me on the phone today is my guest, Dan Pashman, host of the wildly successful award-winning podcast, The Sporkful, a show for eaters, not foodies, and author of the cookbook, Eat More, Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. Dan, it's such an honor to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
So recently, The Sporkful put out a miniseries titled Your Mom's Food that looks at the ways different cultural foods signify our larger differences. So following four families, you showed us how asking the simple question, what's for dinner, can reveal so much about us and the relationships we have with the people we love. And I definitely want to come back and talk about this, but I want to talk to you first about what I learned about your last Thanksgiving, which is that you spatchcocked your turkey, and I did too, for the very first time.
Nice. How'd it go for you?
You know, not that well. It went okay. I did it. It ended up okay in the end, but I was so nervous about overcooking it because of the shortened cooking time that I actually undercooked it, and then we sat around for 20 minutes looking at the sides, so I don't think my family's going to let me do it again this year.
Yeah, I have experimented with a spatchcock, but I have, you know, the thing that's been primarily on my mind as we head in to start the Thanksgiving season is just like how food media contributes to the collective anxiety that we like feel this need to cook something different or new, or like that somehow we're doing it wrong because there's all these other ways to do it. And I feel like I have all the, I'm like contributing to the problem and also a victim of the problem simultaneously.
Well, yeah, you asked on you've been asking people to.
And I'm like, this is good, but I wish it was more like that. And, you know, there's a million ways to do it. I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if maybe part of the problem is that turkey just isn't the greatest thing.
It's true.
It's not the greatest.
It's true. I agree. I think it was probably one of the better turkeys once it got cooked. It wasn't as dried out as it normally is. So I feel like, you know, there's something to be said for it.
Yeah, but like my mother-in-law, she puts a ton of water in the bottom of the pot, and she covers it in foil very tightly and cooks it for like 10 hours at a low temperature, and it like braises the turkey, and it's super soft and tender. But it's totally different from the spatchcock turkey, but it's also really delicious in its own way. And I'm like, I kind of want to try that, you know.
But what do you do with the skin? You have to have the crispy skin.
Someone out there is listening, and they're like, maybe I should do that. Am I doing it wrong?
Well, it's okay. I think whatever everyone does, there's, you know, certain elements that you can't mess up. I did make Joy the Baker's sweet potato pie last year instead of pumpkin pie, which was going kind of rogue, and people liked it. So, you know, there's tweaks to be made.
Nice. There you go.
So I listened to your episode on Cuban food, which wasn't part of the miniseries, but I think, you know, still very relevant for the discussion that we're having today. So it was really about how much of the Cuban food in Cuba is not like much of the Cuban food in Miami. And actually, the Cuban food in Miami is better because of access to the ingredients that aren't available in Cuba. And really this lost food culture that in many ways left when the migrants fled from Cuba to Florida. What do you feel like you learned from doing that episode?
I would push back against a little bit where you said that it's better in Miami. There are some people, like the Cuban, the expats who fled Castro, they all say it's better in Miami. And there are a lot of people who would say that. But, you know, we talked to Chef Doug Rodriguez in the show as well, and he's Cuban-American, but he goes back to Cuba a lot. And he says, no, it's more authentic in Cuba, even though it's different, you know. And so the food, as is often the case, you know, the food quickly became like a stand-in for a long-running political debate, you know, which is, and we got some feedback from people who said, you know, you made it sound like things are too bad in Cuba. And other people say, you made it sound like things are not bad enough in Cuba. And, you know, that's sort of the central argument. But the thing that I learned the most from it was this idea that You know, it's a really interesting question of identity, food and identity. Like, what is the real Cuban food? Part of me says, well, by definition, it's whatever food they're cooking in Cuba. But if external influences, if the policies of the Cuban government and the American government conspire to force the Cuban people to change the food that they're cooking in their kitchens because of scarcity and shortages, well, then, does that mean that Cuban food, is Cuban food the platonic ideal? Is it the food that the people of Cuba would cook if they had all the ingredients they wanted or needed? Or is it whatever they're cooking by definition? Because in Miami, they have all the food they need, and they cook the food that people ate in Cuba 50 or 75 years ago. It was an interesting sort of philosophical question to pose, and I'm not sure what the answer is. It wasn't really our goal in that episode to have a definitive answer one way or the other. I was just intrigued by that question, because there's a lot of cuisines and a lot of dishes that a certain ethnic group or national, or a certain group of people. It becomes their dish out of necessity, perhaps not by choice, but over time and over generations, it still becomes theirs, and over time they take pride in it, and it becomes part of their identity, even if it wasn't their choice to make it that way in the first place. And so you're sort of seeing that happen in real time in Cuba, and I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, you look at some of the most delicious food that we have, and it came from times of strife or peasant foods or these things, where people really had to use what they had around them. And I actually had this experience. So I went to Cuba last year and kind of feel a little bit part of the problem, right, of the whole tourist issue that you guys mentioned on your show. I didn't do any of the food tours and kind of created my own trip. But the food really, to me, wasn't very good, which was a little disappointing after having Miami Cuban food. So it really raised for me this question of authenticity, because I think when we're saying something is authentic or not, people often equate that with being better, right? So if you're getting Indian food in India versus Jackson Heights in New York City, you're thinking the Indian food in India is more authentic because it's better. So what does that really mean then for authenticity when a cultural food is better outside of its homeland, perhaps? Or, does authenticity really even exist then?
Right. Now that's something we wrestle with on the Sporkful a lot. And I feel like at this point, anytime you describe any food as authentic, you have to kind of put a disclaimer on it, because the word itself is, I don't know if I would say that it's problematic, but it's sort of like, you could go to a village in India and you could have two homes right next door to each other, and they could have two different recipes for the exact same dish. So which one of those is authentic? They both would probably strike me as pretty authentic, even if they're different. But I still think that word still applies, and it's still the best word we have for something that's a little bit sort of inexplicable. It's not necessarily in a recipe. It's just something about the feeling behind it, I guess. I don't know. Maybe there's a better way to put it. But, yeah, it's always an interesting question when people describe something as really authentic. And it's sort of like authentic to who, and then who decides what's authentic? And those are questions we struggle with a lot.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's kind of the whole arm of our show, is trying to unpack those and wrestle with those and figure out, what does that look like so everyone can maybe have more of a common language?
Yeah, absolutely.
So in episode of 3, I think it was, of Your Mom's Food, you talked to Soledad O'Brien, who is Cuban, and she was saying that how staying connected to Cuban food was really important to her mother after she left Cuba. And she talked about how now this connection has become less important to her, or less important to her kids, I should say. So when you were doing that show and some of these other ones, what kinds of problems did you see children of immigrant parents running into when they were reconciling their American present with their past or their family's past?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly been something that's been interesting for me to learn more about and hear more about different people's experiences, first-generation folks. I don't want to speak for any of those folks. You can hear them on the Sporkful speaking very well for themselves. But some of the themes that sort of seem to get repeated are the idea of not quite feeling like that you're accepted as a full American, yet when you go back to the country where your parents were born, you feel really super American, and very aware that you're not from that place. and feeling sort of caught between cultures. I think the phrase that Hasan Minhaj used when we had him on, and he uses in his work in general, he's from The Daily Show comedian, is a third culture kid. And so that's something that that we hear a lot. And with Soledad O'Brien, her situation was interesting because she didn't really try that hard. She's not a big food person, and she didn't try that hard to learn her mom's recipes, or she doesn't love to cook, and she it wasn't until it was too late that she came to regret not having learned her mom's recipes more and not having, you know, and not having that connection.
Yeah, that's something that I think about a lot. My grandmother is an immigrant from Romania, and she cooks, obviously, all the Romanian foods of her childhood, which, for good and bad, right? She was there during communism, so the meat's always overdone on Thanksgiving for her. But something that I think about quite often is who preserves those traditions. And I think it's also interesting to think of who gets to serve as the guardians of food culture. So is it those who have left those places and have maybe developed a more sharper critical eye from the outside, or those who remain kind of in the motherland and are still there and evolving with whatever the food culture is evolving with in that place?
Right, absolutely. Well, that's something I've certainly heard, is that especially when you have a large exodus from a certain country coming to the U.S. or going elsewhere, for whatever reason that can obviously happen for a variety of reasons. But when it happens, the people who leave tend to, you know, when they set up in their new home, they're obviously searching for a little piece of the home that they left. And they will try their best to cook the food that they remember from where they came from, but they end up sort of creating a time capsule. And so, for instance, you know, if you ask Chef Rick Bayless, he'll tell you that the food that the high-end chefs in Mexico are cooking today is very different, not just from these sort of like burrito and taco places in the U.S., but also of even the higher-end Mexican places in the U.S., and they're pushing things much forward. And so sometimes, you know, when a large group of immigrants comes, that you get this sort of time capsule effect. And, you know, maybe that's sort of part of what's happening with Cuba. But, yeah, it's interesting also, like, for me, one of the other things I've learned from these conversations, so my wife, she's first generation. Her parents grew up in communist Czechoslovakia. And so when we have these conversations on the Sporkful, sometimes she can really identify with this feeling of sort of growing up as a child of immigrants and feeling like your culture at home is a little different from the culture of your peers. But the flip side is that, you know, that she's white and her parents are white, and so she was able to pass and blend in much more readily and easily. So you also, you know, get a useful lesson about privilege and the benefits that she's had, you know, in spite of being the child of immigrants. There's things that people have talked about on the Sporkful having to deal with that my wife, who's also a child of immigrants, never had to deal with.
Yeah, I have that experience as well. I mean, people meet my mom and she still doesn't have an accent. She came over when she was 14, so she really lost a lot of that. And she has no desire to go back and really no desire to connect with any of the foods really that she grew up with. It's, she completely Americanized. So I think you also see in some people the acceptance to fit in a new culture outweighs the comfort of where you came from.
Right. That's totally right. And also something that I've seen is this situation where you know, the folks who came from another country are very eager to try to fit in as readily as possible and sort of, you know, don't make waves, go with the flow. And their kids then, who are born in the U.S., they grow up feeling much more entitled to push back and to carve out a piece of their own identity and aren't afraid to speak up as much, and that's, you know, sometimes creates generational tensions with their own parents or tensions with people who don't look like them. So those are interesting, difficult situations.
Yeah, absolutely. You are listening to Meant to be Eaten, and when we come back after this break from our sponsors, we will continue talking to Dan Pashman, host of The Sporkful.
Byright is a family-owned and San Francisco-grown market that's passionate about creating community through food. From organic farm direct local produce, sustainably raised meats and artisan cheeses, to food-friendly wines, house-made foods, and dinners, Byright is an essential San Francisco destination for any food lover or cook. And no trip is complete without a visit to the renowned Byright Creamery and Bake Shop for a scoop of salted caramel ice cream. Now celebrating 75 years in the Mission District of San Francisco, visit ByrightMarket.com to learn more. Byright is a proud business member of Heritage Radio Network, supporting good food media from coast to coast.
For those just joining us, I'm on the line with Dan Pashman, host of the popular podcast The Sporkful, and we're talking about the ways that authenticity and food culture issues pop up in unexpected ways. So, Dan, when we talk about cultural appropriation in food, which I'm still hesitant even exists, we're often looking at what's on the outside, right? Yours versus mine. And what you looked at in the Your Mom's Food series is how this question of what's yours and mine shakes out in a household where cultures are really trying to coincide or blend together. Do you feel like there's such a thing as political correctness at home when you're cooking with another's culture, say your husband or wife?
I don't know if I would use the term political correctness, but, you know, anytime two people live together and have a relationship together, there's always going to be grinding edges. There are going to be things that you grew up doing it this way, I grew up doing it that way, I like it better this way, whether it's food or how messy your house is or any one of a million other things that have to be worked out when you share a living space with another human being. And, you know, food is one of the biggest ones because everyone does it and you do it all the time. At least I do. And so it's just, it's sort of a gateway to explore larger issues. And so what we wanted to get into with that was sort of like, well, if, when people in interracial marriages or people from different cultures get married, how do those grinding edges work themselves out in the world of food? And I think it's definitely, like, I don't know that I would use the word political correctness, but
maybe heightened sensitivity.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, look, I think anytime you're living with someone in a long-term relationship, you got to try to be sensitive to where they're coming from.
You do? Wait.
And especially, you know, to try your best to understand their experience and see things through their eyes. And that's something, you know, we can all do better at. So yeah, I think that's a good thing. And sometimes, I would say yes.
Yeah, the producer for the show, Coral, and I, we had a discussion about episode 2 of the series, which features what you called, I think, a meat and potatoes Midwest girl and an Indian masala man, and how they navigate their familial food tensions, if you will. And Coral was saying that she thought the episode didn't come out as, you know, a tidy package with a bow with them really reconciling on their differences. And I actually liked that about it, because when we're talking about these issues, we're talking about real life, and sometimes it doesn't come out as perfect or ideal. And it's like, this is, you know, how we're choosing to deal with this right now. And I know that you and your wife have also navigated some of these tensions. You did a whole episode about it. So what did this series bring up for you, or what did you take away from it at your own home?
Well, I think it was nice that my wife, so one of the episodes was my wife and I talking about how she grew up in a kosher, where, like, you know, there's a couple episodes in the series where it's like, this person is, like you said, Indian guy and a white Midwestern girl, and, you know, it's an obvious, it looks on paper like an obvious culture clash, whereas, you know, on paper, my wife and I are both white Jewish American people from the New York metro area. Like, it seems like, well, that should be an easy one. And yet, we have our own food tensions in our house sometimes, because my wife was raised in a kosher home and I wasn't. And so the idea of meat and cheese together on the same plate just weirds her out, even though she's not super religious. It's just that when you've been raised a certain way, then, you know, you have those feelings. And so, you know, I think it was good for us to, you know, I had kind of resisted, you know, early in our relationship when we first started, when we were living together, there was tension over how kosher our home should be. And she was never saying, I want it to be super duper strict kosher. And I was never saying, like, let's cook pork chops all day long. But you know, exactly where in the middle we were going to meet was a question. You know, like a truly kosher home would have two separate sets of dishes and pots and pans, one for meat and one for dairy, because meat and dairy can't mix. And I didn't really want to do that. But I also agree, like, okay, I won't cook pork or shellfish in the home. So we had our kind of tenuous compromise, and I always figured that when we had kids, I worried that would become like the new battleground. How kosher are our kids going to be? Will we let them eat cheeseburgers when they're at a friend's house or at our house? And instead, what's happened is that actually it's become less of an issue. I think my wife, we just sort of adjusted to the compromise, and my wife more so than I have has just kind of mellowed on the issue and has let some of these things go. But I had never really talked to her about it. I never really said, like, how come? Why aren't we fighting about this? Because, you know, when you're not fighting about something, it's better to just not bring it up. I was afraid that I would sort of bring up old resentments. But doing that episode gave us a chance to talk about those issues and me to kind of understand. And it was really nice, actually. She basically said that, you know, food is way more important to me than it is to her. Like, she's not super into food. Every time I go away for work, she always jokes that she always loses weight because she doesn't eat anything. She just, like, forgets to eat dinner and then has, like, half a bowl of cereal on the couch while she watches TV after the kids go to bed. Whereas when I'm home, I'm like, I'm going to make this, and it's going to be awesome, and let's all pig out. So, because food's so important to me, and especially like our older daughter loves to eat and we love to eat together. And, you know, my wife's feeling was like, that's something that's really important to me. And it's something that I bond with the kids on, and we cook together, and I cook with the kids, and we have a lot of fun doing that. And so, like, that's more important to her, like us bonding and having that thing to share with each other. My daughters and I is more important to her, to my wife, than observing kosher rules.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And so and I didn't know that that's how she felt. I just hadn't ever raised it because I felt like, let's just let sleeping dogs lie. But
still no bacon. Still no bacon at home.
That was what I learned.
Are you guys still not doing bacon? I know in the episode you guys had discussed it, but you're still not cooking bacon at home.
No, and the truth is, I mean, this is a controversial statement, but I think bacon's kind of overrated anyway. Like, if I was going to push for a pork product to be cooked in my house, it wouldn't be bacon, and it's really not that healthy. And so it's like, my daughter can get her bacon at the diner. Like, I don't really care. I'd love to be able to grill a pork chop now and again. That would be really nice.
Like some good carnitas or something like that. That would be at the top of the list.
I'm happy with cheeseburgers. If I can do cheeseburgers, you know, that's fine. The pork products I can get outside the home.
That's fair. What inspired you to put out the series?
Well, we've done a few different series on food and race and culture and how they all come together. The first one was now about a year and a half ago called Other People's Food. And when we did that one, a friend of mine texted me and was like, that one was more on the nose about cultural appropriation. He was saying he's got a friend who's white, who adopted two kids from Ethiopia, and she sometimes takes them out for Ethiopian food as a way to kind of connect with their culture of origin. And that other series had gotten him wondering, well, like, how authentic of an experience is that? And what if it's not Ethiopians who are making the food in the kitchen? What does that mean? But I was just very struck. I had never heard of the idea that of people who adopt kids from other cultures or other countries using food as a way to connect them to their culture of origin. And it turns out that that's a fairly common practice. I just was ignorant about it, but it struck me as really interesting. And so that was the first kernel. And I've also, separately from that, I've always been super interested in the way that, in the science of how our palates are formed, like the genetics of how our palates are formed. To what degree do we pass down our palates from one generation to the next? Do we inherit our eating habits? To what degree are they environmental? Obviously, everything is a little bit nature and nurture, but like, I'm fascinated by the science of it. And so those were the first initial two questions: the adoption, like the food and cross-cultural adoption, and the science of and then the science led me to just thinking more generally about, like, how do we pass on culture through food? And that became really the big question of the series, like, from one generation to the next. how do we pass our cultures on through food, and what happens when there are grinding edges between different cultures in the same household, or when people from different cultures are living under the same roof? How does that work out, and what are the tensions and what are the complications? So that was the series.
Yeah, I mean, the series was really well done, and I was excited to see it. It came out, you know, right around the same time that we launched this show, and so there was some interesting crossover, and the way that you had chosen the stories and the people that you featured, I thought, was really well done. How did you choose those stories specifically to feature? You mentioned, obviously, your friend with the Ethiopian adoption, but the other ones, how did you find who to talk to?
Well, it was a combination, and I should give a shout out to my the producer of The Sporkful, Anne Noyes Stanny, who does an awesome job, and she's instrumental. I mean, she was featured in episode two, so that's how I found her. She sits right next to me in the office. But you know, in the process of talking through, you know, a series like that is months in the making, and so it's a lot of conversations, and we'll kind of talk through an idea, and then kind of forget about it, and then talk about it again. And in one of the conversations, Anne was saying, "Yeah, this kind of, you know, this is something that I struggle with." And I was like, "Well, maybe you should be on the show." And then I thought, "Well, then maybe I should be on the show too, because I've struggled with it with my wife too." And so we decided, you know, we're sometimes reticent to make the show about ourselves, but we felt like this was an appropriate situation. And so that was that. And then the other part of for the adoption episode, partly it was the friend through my friend's connection who had the Ethiopian adoptees, but then we talked to two Korean American adoptees, and that was just sort of like, you know, putting calls out, friends of friends, doing some research, tracking people down. But you know, that's a painstaking part of the process. So we're fortunate to be able to take that amount of time, but you know, there's a lot of conversations with folks that don't end up in the show before you find just the right people.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've talked to so many different people, and you know, we have this conversation going on about cultural appropriation in food. You mentioned Rick Bayless, for example, or you know, something like Noma, Mexico, or you know, even some of the smaller things like the burrito cart out in Portland, Oregon. What are your thoughts on cultural appropriation in food? Is it possible, or how do you think about that?
Well, I guess I would say a couple of things. I think it is possible. It certainly, like, it can exist. But I try hard not to put myself in the position of becoming, like, the cultural appropriation police. I don't really feel like it's my place to be the guy who decides when something is problematic and when it's not. The thing that I have learned from working on that issue and some of these more sensitive issues of race and culture and food over the past couple years has been that, like, my biggest takeaway is that I think that too often the question becomes, is it cultural appropriation or is it not cultural appropriation? Or, like, is this racist or is it not racist? Is that person racist or are they not racist? Or is this idea or whatever it is? And it becomes like, is it right or wrong? Is it okay or not okay? And it becomes this binary debate where everyone is supposed to take sides. And I feel like as soon as that becomes the framework of the conversation, it's rare that something positive comes from that conversation, because it becomes, people quickly just sort of like fall into their pre-existing camps. Instead, the question that I try to ask myself and try to get Sporkful listeners to ask themselves and guests to ask themselves, and that I would encourage people to ask themselves and each other, is, can you see it from this other person's point of view? Like, try really, like, pause for a second and forget, stop worrying for a second about who's right or wrong. And just try as best you can to put yourself in this person's shoes and really think about the experience they've had and the life that they've had as best you can. Of course, you can never fully understand what it is to be another person. But, like, do your best. Try really hard to really take a second and imagine what this person's life has been like. And then, once you've done that and really taken a minute to do that, can you understand, once you're in that other person's shoes, how they can see it the way they see it? That doesn't mean you have to agree necessarily. It doesn't mean you have to say that they're right and admit that you're wrong. It just means that you can see it. Just acknowledge that, like, that somebody else's perspective has validity. And I think, you know, that's what I try to do. And I think that seems to me to lead to like a more not only a more productive and useful and positive place in conversation, but also a more interesting one.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of what we all need right now, more empathy and respect for other points of view and different cultures, especially as we continue to become more global and things become more and more interconnected.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, right. No, totally, 100%, you know, and it's just, it really isn't that hard, but it's just like, it's so much easier to just say like, is this right or wrong? Take a side.
Right.
You know, and like, that's just what it becomes. And like, each person has an opinion and people just, everybody wants to have an opinion or a take. And I just think that like the better question to ask is, can you see it from this other person's point of view?
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, Dion, thank you so much for the inspiring conversation. It was such a pleasure to talk to you. And I highly recommend, if you haven't already, to check out the show, The Sporkful, found wherever podcasts are found. Dion, will you let people know how to find you online?
Yeah, it's at sporkful.com or anywhere you listen to your podcasts. I hope you'll check out The Sporkful.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm your host, Andrea Wien. You just listened to Meant to be Eaten. And remember, if it's coming from a mom's stove, it's definitely meant to be eaten.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.